What's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. I am Jamie Dodd, my co-host, Canucks insider Thomas Drantz, who also covers the team for The Athletic. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at dleamc.com. We are live from the Kintech studio. Kintech, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Drantz, what's going on, man?
Hey, buddy.
You've changed,
not much.
You've changed outfits. Where's resort wear, Drantz, that you showed off on Donnie and Dolly earlier today?
I came inside. I came inside.
Well, you can still wear a tropical shirt inside.
No, you can't.
What?
No. Who does that?
You take it off every time you go inside?
Absolutely.
Like, what if you're out on at a beach town or something, you're in a bar? You wear a tropical shirt. What's wrong with that?
But those bars are kind of like partially outdoors.
Some are. That's true.
You know what
that's
I'm saying? True. Like, there you're like, like a thatched hut is not indoors. Like, the air-conditioned, you know, sound-controlled environment of my home office. So, no, I took it off. I take it off to swim. I take it off to go indoors. It's exclusively outside.
Two things that are totally the same. Swimming and being indoors.
Yes.
Absolutely. Absolute parallels.
I consider them to be identical activities. Yeah.
We're really like reaching incredible levels of off-season wild takes and rapid pace here on the station. I'm still kind of marveling at how fast we collectively went from like digesting a big emotional Game 7 loss to the Oilers to, and this is a direct quote from the morning show today, would you pay Art Garfunkel 7x7? The speed we went from those two things, truly astounding. Game 7 was last week, and here we are. It is full on off-season summer mode on the station right now.
The off-season sucks.
I mean, there's some positives too, but yes, the playoffs were more fun. The playoffs were more fun. Don't get me wrong.
My lifestyle's vastly improved, but the topic of conversation now is just like, should they sign one of these guys they clearly shouldn't sign? It's like, no. Like, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah. I don't know how.
What
many...
about this guy? Good. It's like, yeah, at his previous contract value.
I don't know how many more Elias Lindholm debates we need to have.
Are people really even debating it?
I don't know. I don't know that I've seen a single like strong pounding the table they have to bring Lindholm back take. I think it's almost exclusively been like cautionary, it doesn't make sense, can't commit that type of money to a third line center. Like, I don't know if there's anyone who's planted their flag on must return Elias Lindholm.
I mean, other than, I feel like I've planted my flag on Hronek.
Yep.
But I feel like that's about it. Like, I don't know. Engaging with the market, everyone else seems like, you know, there's some Zadorov. There's definitely some Zadorov love and some Dakota Joshua, but
yeah, Zadorov.
You know, it's scattered.
Zadorov, I would say, is the big one that people are going to be most. At least in the moment, even if there's like the recognition that, hey, he signed another contract somewhere else and that contract looks dangerous, there's going to be the most kind of emotional sense of loss if Nikita Zadorov goes elsewhere, right? And like we've seen a ton of takes along the lines of like trade Hronek, use that money to keep Zadorov. So I think there is going to be that reaction to Zadorov, even if people will recognize, like, you know what, that contract doesn't make a ton of sense. I mean, you get that, right? You're always talking about how much you love watching the guy and love covering him. Like, you can both...
Yeah, he rocks.
You can both think that whatever contract he signs this summer is going to be a mistake for the team that signs it, and also be sad not to have Nikita Zadorov around Vancouver long term.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I don't know that it's going to be a mistake for any team that signs it.
That's fair.
You know, like, if you're trying to sell hockey in Salt Lake City, like, come watch giant Russian guy mash people and then say funny stuff is, like, a good part of the pitch.
NHL,
there's a way to live up to that contract in that environment.
NHL agents must be all collectively doing cartwheels that Utah is a thing now. Like, how we're going to predict and like pitch every notable UFA and play an RFA and player on the trade market to Utah. It's like, well, Utah, they're going to be aggressive. They need to do something. Could they be interested in this guy? That's going to be part of every conversation about a high profile free agent this summer.
Well, especially the defenseman, because you look at how that roster is constructed, right? And it's just very clear. It's very clear what they need. So yeah, no, I mean, you're right. And again, so if you're Utah or you're Chicago, you know, I mean, I think Zadorov at market price actually makes a ton of sense. You know, like, honestly, if you're Toronto, I mean, Zadorov was a media darling here, but their needs on defense are even more severe in some ways than a team with three guys signed for next season. You know, the fact that we have zero doubt about Zadorov's ability to handle like that limelight, you know, that should be appealing.
Their need for swagger in Toronto as well. And like swagger that can play. Seriously. So you're not relying on Ryan Reeves to be the guy.
You want someone who can score some clutch goals from bad angles in the playoffs? We've got your 6'5" Russian defensive defenseman. And I'd add Chicago, because like at some point you're going to want someone who, if anyone so much as breathes on Bedard, they're going to rush in, right? Throw him off. And then, like, make fun of their family to the media afterwards or something. You know, like, that's just how it is. So, again, yeah, no, I mean, that's what's sort of funny about this is, like, you know, I have a lot of time for all of these Canucks pending unrestricted free agents. I think there's an awful lot of them who make sense for a lot of teams. I think there's an awful lot of them who make sense for Vancouver. It's just the collective approach, like the big picture approach. You know, caution needs to be the word of the day, right? Like that's, and we all kind of know it, you know, it's an interest, even the fans kind of know it. And then, you know, we sort of work through what matters most, right? Like, and that's been, I feel like the topic of our conversations all week. It was the topic of my Halford and Brough conversation, at least when I wasn't, you know, slandering Paul Simon, which was, I seriously, like, I get that his solo career was great. Don't get me wrong. It's just that no one's going to remember it relative to, you know, The Sound of Silence and The Best of Simon and Garfunkel. Surely that's not controversial.
Okay, the only thing I'll say is we'll move on from this. I promise everyone, we will move on from this. I'm not like a massive Paul Simon fan, with the exception of the album Graceland, which is like an all-time Hall of Fame, hugely influential, critical smash success, commercial smash success album. So like just that album, I that's in like permanent heavy rotation in my house. Like I got the vinyl copy,
really?
The whole thing. Yes. Like I would say as a family collective, one of our favorite albums to listen to. And I know there's lots of people out there because it is that influential an album. So for me, I will always hold that in much higher regard. Like, I can't remember the last time I put on Simon and Garfunkel, even though I like, you know, as you said, Sounds of Silence and Bridge Over Troubled Water and everything, right? But so that's my perspective on it, is that he did actually have a higher peak away from Art Garfunkel with Graceland. Anyways.
No, but like, I see what you're saying. You might like the album more, but at the end of the day,
I see what you're saying.
Years,
it's the more iconic stuff was with Garfunkel.
In 40 years, people are still going to understand the cultural reference, like Cuckoo, Ka-choo, Mrs. Robinson.
That's true.
You know, like that's still going to have some level of cultural cachet in a way that Under African Skies or, you know, Gumboots just isn't, as much as there is affection for that album in your house.
I'm just saying, don't, like, it's not like I'm a quirky person for loving that album. It was a massive, success and hugely influential.
But it's like rocking Graceland and being like, what a great album, is the equivalent of watching Hughes and Shen and being like, what a good pair. This is one of the good things about this Canucks team.
No, it's not, though. It's not.
Yes.
that's where you're wrong.
Versus what Hughes and Hronek did, elevating, where Hughes is going to be the first defenseman in franchise history to win the Norris. Analogy is perfect because of Simon's strength. That's why it works.
No, I disagree. Yes. Anyways, I really don't want to spend the whole show on this. We've already like far exceeded our quota. far exceeded our quota for Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel talk here.
I love how outraged people are about it, though.
Yeah, no, it's actually, I got to say, it's generated a lot of feedback. And even like, so
a lot.
My part of my morning routine is I listen to the first segment of Halford and Brough on podcast, like while I'm in the shower, getting ready, just to like, you know, keep tabs on what everyone's saying, like what the conversation is in the market. And I pulled up the podcast on my phone today as I was getting into the shower, and like part of the description was like, you know, the guys talk about the conference finals and also Drance's take on Simon and Garfunkel. Like it wasn't like incidental to the show. It was built in. They were like, this is on the rundown. We have the clip prepared. Brough had taken notes and like had a take on it. It was like a central part of the first hour of the show.
Oh. When I went on and guested, you should have heard his Kintec read. Like, I honestly feel like we owe Kintec a make good because he was like, oh, I'm a Kintec. He was just like raging through it.
I knew
he was coming for me at that moment.
Yeah. And my favorite one was somebody texted in and Brough read it on air like, guys, this is my parents' music and I'm 52. Which is an incredibly line. Just an incredibly good line. Okay, we'll leave that aside for now. I'm sure we'll find something else ridiculous to get into at some point throughout the course of the show. I did just want to take a step back because, as you've said, we've all kind of, I think, got to say our piece on priorities, you know, most important UFAs to keep, dangerous contracts to avoid, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, kind of the theoretical priorities and big pictures. But we're at this time now where we're basically a month away from the next real deadline, which is June 30th, the deadline for qualifying offers, right? You know, we'll see how that shakes out around the league. Sometimes there's some interesting RFAs that don't get qualified and become UFAs. But in terms of kind of what to watch for, what to expect from the Canucks over the next few weeks, like before we get to the real, like the draft, free agency, et cetera, because I think it's interesting, right? Because now we have at least one opening on the bench with Mike Yeo's departure, if not multiple, right? Because we were already wondering if they're going to add someone. And then you have this crop of UFAs, and there's so many different ways that could go, from getting deals done early, trading rights potentially if it comes to that, although that's usually a closer to July 1st type of thing when it does happen. So before we, in the kind of calm before the storm here that really kicks in around the draft and free agency, what, if anything, are you kind of watching for or expecting to see out of the Canucks over the next couple of weeks?
I mean, honestly, my focus mostly is on the unrestricted free agent negotiations. You know, I do expect that they get a deal done, or, you know, before July 1. They're going to have time to keep who they want. Like, they're going to have time to make, a thorough list of priorities, negotiate, and reach the point of some yes-nos on some really key pieces. Like, some, you know, Zadorov played top-line minutes in the meat of the playoffs, or top-pair minutes in the meat of the playoffs. Elias Lindholm, you know, was their second-line center ahead of Elias Pettersson when the games were heaviest, when the games mattered the most. Dakota Joshua was a top-six winger in the playoffs. Yeah. I mean, you go down the list, like, on the one hand, you know, like, these are not peripheral players as much as I think the club needs to be cautious in prioritizing or slotting them appropriately from a cap perspective. These are players who played a huge role for a team that the market really came to love. And so for me, like, way more than the assistants or, like, will they sign Person tomorrow? And that's an actual player whose rights will expire on June 1st, by the way.
A Canucks
is it Victor?
Drafty.
Victor Person?
Victor Person, I believe. And I'm pretty sure the answer is no, by the way. If you're asking about
100%.
His first name, I think the answer is no, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Victor, and his nickname is Real. Victor Real Person. And then he actually exists, I'm sure of it. No, I mean, there's that side of it. I guess one thing to watch for, just because we'll always have to bring this up in the wake of the Johansson and Nils Åman deals, is like
other guys that don't. Yep.
Yeah, the Canucks have played in that market before. So, I'll certainly be perusing the list of guys, unsigned draft picks, and seeing if there's anyone, that looks like an interesting bet. That's sort of, I guess, the first deadline up. And then, you know, we know that the club is in pro meetings this week, having gone through amateur meetings last week. So, you know, I'd imagine that they're whittling down on priority targets and figuring out exactly what they want this team to look like and where they want to spend their money and where they want to spend their cap space. You know, I do still think like Hronik's the one that is most likely to go long, right? There, you don't really have to get that one done this month. The UFAs, you really want to have done before the Stanley Cup is awarded, right? I mean, the closer you get to market, the better sense everyone has of exactly what the pecking order looks like in unrestricted free agency. Players kind of have a good sense. Those deals don't tend to get magically done exactly at noon on July 1, right? It's like these, you know, the NHL no longer has a legal tampering period, but make no mistake, right? You're going to know exactly what to expect well before, certainly by the time you get to the draft. So, you know, I think for me, that's the main one is like, I'm not that interested in the buyout window. I don't think the club intends to buy out Ilya Mikheyev. I could see that changing. But I would be surprised by that, at least like small S surprised by that. So that one doesn't loom too large in my imagination. Qualifying offer deadlines, like, I don't know. I mean, as much as Canucks fans are freaking out about every Instagram post that anyone on the Canucks or Abbotsford Canucks or their partners puts out there, that's like, I'm going to miss this place because I'm leaving for 5 months. Like, totally normal leaving for the offseason. People are like, they know they're leaving. It's like, come on, guys, we really have to stop reading between the lines like this. But the, you know, that the qualifying offer deadline, it doesn't feel like there's a ton of suspense. It's not like it was a couple of years ago with Besser.
Right.
Where there was like a really complicated one, a really crunchy one to be mindful of. I mean, I guess there's a chance. Could the Canucks decide to non-tender Hronik? I mean, I don't think so.
No, you'd be
handing him too much leverage.
Yeah, that would be bizarre.
Yeah, you can't be that scared of the arbitration award, especially because it's going to be at a level you can walk away from.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there's not a lot of suspense around that one. The draft, like, they don't even have picks.
They don't have picks in the first or second round.
Yeah, like the draft will be interesting because of the possibility for movement, but it's not like in previous years where, you know, I'm sitting around being like, Benson, pick Benson. Please pick Benson. Oh my God, they're not going to pick him. Oh my God, oh no. And then just like be flooded with people saying, you think you know better? And then 2 years later, everyone's like, oh man, they really should have picked that guy Drance was pounding the table about. Just like Stankoven, just like on and on. It's not that I'm wrong. It's that you don't agree with me.
Okay. All right.
You haven't
come to the realization
yet. Anyway.
Rated it.
I don't want to deal with that. And I'm happy we don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
To be honest with you, draft coverage. I mean, man, we've gotten so deep in the weeds on draft coverage the last few years.
Oh, man.
It's going to be nice to not do that.
We haven't talked about it like at all. I think we've asked Bukola like one question about it in his hits with us. And that's about it. We've talked about Celebrini a little
occasionally
bit.
Occasionally we sing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Occasionally we sing the praises of some WHL prospects and like move on with our lives. But like mostly they're like 2026 WHL.
That's right. Gavin eligibles. McKenna, baby.
Let's go. So, yeah, I mean, honestly, for me, it's just the UFAs. Like it's the club's going to have somewhere in the mid 20s in cap flex. How much of that is accounted for before the market opens? Like how much do they actually spend before the market opens? You know, that to me is by far the biggest story of the next month and, you know, probably the biggest story of this offseason, because I think that's going to determine just how different this team looks.
Yeah, and you mentioned the buyout window and kind of the lack of drama, relatively speaking, around that, right, with Ilya Mikheyev. And the Mikheyev situation is interesting, right, because I know that Rick Dhaliwal has kind of said a couple of times, hey, they're working to clear cap space. They're trying to do these other things. You know, even Elliot Friedman kind of referenced they've got a lot of balls in the hopper, I think is what he said. And that could be just negotiations with UFAs. It could mean trying to do other things. But one of the interesting things that kind of sets this offseason apart from previous offseasons, if you're talking about the idea of trying to create cap space, like really we're talking about one name and it's Ilya Mikheyev. Right? Because everyone else who's under contract for next year is either a core player signed into the future, right? Like Pettersson, Miller, Quinn Hughes, or there's somebody like Brock Besser or Connor Garland who, yeah, is there an argument to be made for selling high on one of them? I guess, but they also play the position that the team most desperately needs to fill, right? And then everyone beyond that doesn't make enough money to really talk about in the clearing cap space conversation. So I have no doubt that the team would love to open up more cap space, but in like we're talking about it in generalities sometimes, but really it comes down to Ilya Mikheyev. And, you know, you're saying you'd be kind of small s surprised if they choose to do the buyout. How surprised would you be if there is a trade to clear cap space, like trading him, attaching a sweetener, getting another team to take some percentage of the deal off their hands for the final couple years of Ilya Mikheyev?
That I could see. That I could see. I mean, I think they'll explore their options. I would be big capital S surprised if they didn't. Like, I would be shocked if they weren't gauging interest and figuring out what their options are and seeing if there's, like, is there a one-year deal, you know, like, for $1 million or, you know, like, all sorts of different permutations of that, right? Because, say, you take a one-year contract, like, a guy who's expiring but has, like, five or six. Even if you're investing cap space short term, there's still a cap benefit to doing that, right? Like, that's still preferable to a buyout, especially if that player fits your needs better, right? If you're going to go big game hunting for a forward, right, is can you make taking Mikheyev as part of that transaction? Is there a team out there that would do that? You know, would a team like Chicago view it as a buy low and they're just like, we need NHL players? Hey, you know, a Mikheyev, Blackwell, Dickinson checking line. Like, let's go. Hey, why are you sneering at Jason Dickinson?
I'm not at Jason Dickinson. It's the whole combo and getting excited
of
about
Mikheyev,
it.
Dickinson, Blackwell?
Like, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just like if you're using that like enticing voice to talk yourself into it, that's maybe not an ideal situation to be in. But nothing
against
Jason
Dickinson.
Did
you see the lineups they iced this year? That's a huge improvement.
That's what I mean. That's the problem.
That rules. I'm just like, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, let's go. Three credible NHLers.
Ooh. On one line?
Oh, baby.
Wow, I didn't know they were allowed to do that.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm fine with, the Mikheyev solution, if there is one, I just think you need to be more flexible than a buyout. And my understanding is the club's, you know, very much didn't enter pro meetings in this offseason with a buyout being sort of like a top line consideration as a way to solve that issue. I do still think, and I don't think it's pure lip service, that there's still some hope that he can bounce back, that really at no point has he been the player they ever signed in the first place, given that he sustained a torn ACL in his very first like Canucks preseason debut. So I'm not expecting a buyout there, but I am expecting them to turn over rocks to figure out if they can move that salary, especially if they're considering something like Lindholm, you know, which all indications are they're at least going to consider it, right?
Yeah.
Like, for me, if you sign Lindholm, it's like, well, that's, you know, that plus Hronek, that's kind of like your two big ticket items, and now you're fleshing out the depth of your roster. You kind of have, like, two bullets or in the chamber on guys who are going to cost, like, $5+ million. You know, a third line center just feels like the wrong ammunition to use. But in a world where you are able to clear Mikheyev, then does that change the discussion or at least the balance that you're waiting in determining whether or not to take a run at Lindholm? I mean, that to me would be the dynamic where if Mikheyev moves, if the club is really incentivized to get creative there, it's going to be because they have another bird in hand, as opposed to just like desperation to get off that deal.
Yeah. The complicating factor, though, is, as you said, right, in terms of draft capital, no first, no second. So your options of attaching a sweetener to get some team to take Mikheyev at whatever retention it works out to is very limited, right? So I think given that, you have to be really, really sure you're putting that cap space to use on a true needle mover, right? Before you're willing to part with even more futures to move Mikheyev. And we'll take a break in a second here, but there are people texting in, right? You know, hey, I think Mikheyev will be fine next season. This texture says, I don't know about you guys, but I had an ACL tear. It took a year and a half to 2 years to get back to somewhat normal. And I think we did start to see the speed return for Ilya Mikheyev towards the end of the season. It was the finishing and the puck handling, which was, you know, just completely deserted him. But to your point about him being an effective third line player, I mean, the other thing to consider here is, and I know Bruff made this point during your guys' hit on the morning show, they're losing or potentially losing basically all of their key penalty killers from the playoffs, right? Like, they are all unrestricted free agents. Mikheyev wasn't in that list, but can fully healthy with a proper summer and a proper training camp, Ilya Mikheyev be kind of a key penalty killer for you? And how valuable is that to have in-house when you're potentially looking at Dakota Joshua, Teddy Bluger, et cetera, go down the list. Guys departing who are a big part of the PK in the playoffs. Okay, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. This person texts in, the Mikheyev solution sounds like the next John le Carré novel, which is a very good text. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Send your thoughts in. What are your burning questions about the Canucks off season? We've got some coming in. We will hit them on the other side a little later in the show. Allison Lucan from Seattle joins us, and then our very own Satyar Shah at 1:30. So lots more coming up here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver. Online at dunbarlumber.com. And we do have lots of good texts coming in to the Dunbar Lumber text line, wondering about what the Canucks might do in the offseason. And I wanted to read this one from Cody from Canucks Army. Shout out to Cody, who texts in asking about a kind of off the radar player slash contract on the Canucks books, which is, of course, Tucker Poolman. And he says, is the final year of Tucker Poolman's LTIR deal a valuable asset that they have to try to deal? There are teams, he says, like Vegas and Tampa hurting for space. And I know that you have mentioned as well that the being an LTIR, kind of a difficult pill to swallow for this front office, right? Because it means you're not accruing cap space throughout the course of the season. That really limited what they were able to do beyond Lindholm at the trade deadline. In fact, they ended up not doing anything else at the trade deadline, aside from adding Elias Lindholm. But the mechanics of LTIR are always extremely, extremely complicated, right? And so I'm not sure what exact circumstances, what situation another team would have to be in for them to actively look at the ability to put Tucker Poolman on LTIR as something attractive to them in the summer.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you this. The Canucks internally don't believe that Tucker Poolman's contract will be something that they can move without paying sweeteners.
Okay.
Like, they think that it will cost a premium price in order to get off of that contract, and that's not a premium price that the club's going to pay. Like, they're willing to part with futures, but if they do, it's going to be to acquire players, right? Like, I mean, we've been talking about this club needing to make a big swing. You know what big swings require? Assets, right? Like, you have to pay.
Yep.
And you're going to have to pay to move off of Tucker Poolman. I mean, there are situations where teams want to acquire, you know, contracts that like push them further into LTI, and they sort of, you know, are able to get something for taking on the administrative headache of managing it. But usually teams that part with those deals, whether it's like Dave Boland to Arizona, net something for it. Usually you pay a team to take that LTI contract. I don't think the Canucks have any appetite to do that. So I think you're going to have another year.
Yeah.
Where the club is structurally in LTI is as a result of, you know, the sins of the past. And, you know, thereafter, there's going to be all sorts of fun mechanisms available to this team, especially with Abbotsford just down the road, to toll daily space, to, you know, enter the deadline. This is, by the way, so the cap, when we talk about cap space, we talk about like round numbers, a face value.
Yep.
Cap space as opposed to like real cap space, right? So we're talking about 10 million in cap space, or the Canucks have 25 million in cap space. But of course, the cap is actually calculated daily. And if you're out of LTI and below the daily threshold, that money rolls over every day that you're under to the point where you can hit the deadline and you can have 78 million in face value cap space under an $83.5 million cap, so 5 million in space, but actually have the ability to add 8 or 9 million, which, by the way, is the problem with like the LTI shenanigans solution of having a cap compliant lineup in the playoffs. It's like, well, what if you've managed your roster and never been over the cap and never even used LTI, and now you can't play your optimal roster in the playoffs. Like, it doesn't make sense. It's never made sense. People are just whining to whine. Anyway.
Well, it's also one of the drawbacks of like the theoretical just put guys on LTI. It's like, well, that has real limitations and real constraints to what you can do in season to improve your team.
Yeah. No, LTI is not cap space. Like, LTI space is distinct from cap space, and it is less valuable. Right? Like, it is less valuable with more drawbacks. Maybe you could make it more significant. Like the NBA, the new CBA with the second apron rules, where you like are prevented from doing all kinds of stuff in season. Like, you lose your, you know, the exception and on and on. Maybe that's something to consider, is like, do you make the cost to teams being in LTI even more prohibitive in the next CBA? That would be something that makes more sense to me than changing the playoff rules or like putting teams in a situation. Like, we don't want teams playing the biggest games of their lives or managing like the return of a player who's scrambling to get back, like a Gabriel Landeskog. Like, what we definitely don't want is if Gabriel Landeskog had been like, if the Avs had advanced to the Cup final and Gabriel Landeskog, having worked for 18 months to recuperate, was like able to play, and you're not able to put him in the lineup for some esoteric rule designed to prevent Vegas from making the deadline interesting every year. It's like, that's what we don't want. We absolutely do not want that, those sorts of things, to be impacting teams' decisions in the biggest games of the lives of all players and all fans and all customers involved. Like, come on, that's nonsense. But something like that, like something where,
yep,
if you're in LTI, you know, and if you're in LTI for multiple seasons, you know, are unable to do XYZ, that to me would be, you know, that's the sort of punitive measure that might make sense to come at those teams that exploit it. Anyway, more than that, though, the Canucks have their hands tied a little bit in season in terms of their ability to accumulate space. They have ever since Abbotsford relocated from Utica, which is too bad, because there's all sorts of options available, especially if you're creative and dexterous about how you manage it. So, but yeah, no, I don't think the Canucks are going to have any appetite to pay the required freight to get off of Pullman. And I know internally they view that as certainly not an asset that like could help them make a trade, but as a negative value one to be navigated around.
And you mentioned, you know, right, the importance of just assets, right? If you are going to make a big swing, right, the phrase we keep using, and understandably so, because this team needs that star talent, especially at forward at the top of the lineup, you need those assets. If it's not an unrestricted free agent, you need to give the other team something significant. And this text comes in from Andrew and Langley. Does Hoglander have enough cachet to help get a difference maker in the top six? 23 years old, $1.1 million for another season with Arbrights next summer. Had a high shooting percentage this season. Is this the time to use him to upgrade before he regresses? And we can talk about Hoglander specifically, but as I said earlier in the show, right, one of the interesting things about this Canucks season is so many players had such incredible years. Now, a lot of them are UFAs, so that puts the Canucks in a bit of a difficult situation with them. But, you know, often when that happens, you're trying to look for the sell-high candidates. And I think two of the names that would jump to mind would be Brock Besser and Connor Garland. But, you know, as I said, like, you need top six caliber wingers on this team. So it's really hard to see how that would make sense. But Nils Höglander would be another interesting one, right? Now, he's a winger and he's a scoring winger who's had 24 even strength goals this year. Yes, with a high shooting percentage. So there is still plenty of risk if you decide to go down that road of considering trading him. But if you're just talking about assets the Canucks have that could move the needle in a package, I mean, you're looking at, what, the 2025 first, Lekkerimäki, Volander, and then Höglander might be next on that list. So that doesn't mean you have to trade him, but if we're discussing, you know, okay, hey, assets that can go land a real top-of-the-lineup player, like, I think Höglander is going to come up in those conversations they're having with other teams.
Oh, for sure. I mean, there's no doubt that Höglander is a marketable asset. I mean, there are lots of teams that would rate him highly. But, you know, I'm not sure that I buy the, like, I heard Satyar Shah, we can debate it with him when we have him on at 1:30, but I heard Satyar Shah make the point that this is probably the high ebb of his trade value. And I actually think that's a sharp point. So while I'm about to disagree with it on air, I'm not actually disagreeing with the logic or the process by which he comes to that suggestion. I think that's well-founded. We all know that despite Hoglander being among the NHL's most efficient 5-on-5 scorers this season, you know, he also regularly played fourth line minutes. He also shot 20%. He's a career 12.5% shooter. He shot 20% this season, scoring 24 times on a grand total of 120 shots on net. Not likely to repeat that, right? I mean, the idea of Hoglander as stud goal scorer, right? Like stud rate stat all-star goal scorer, I think is one that will likely recede, right? I do not believe that Nils Hoglander's ceiling case involves him being like even a consistent 25 goal guy necessarily. But I think when you consider the leaps and bounds that he improved, you know, in his age 23 season this past year as a two-way player, right, as like a more reliable option, from Boudreau absolutely would not play him to, you know, he was a relatively consistent option in the top six and like worked his way up the lineup over the course of the season and granted fell a little bit out of the lineup in the playoffs. So it wasn't like a meteoric or completely uncomplicated rise, but his two-way game, you know, and it's like really simple stuff. He, you know, this is a classic talkatism, but his line changes were too long and then he'd be tired and then he'd get exposed defensively. And it was like he was sharper on those just small details that help make such a huge difference. I mean, I look at the work rate and like how sticky he is on the wall and the way that he wins battles and just the overall hockey sense and think, man, there's no reason why in his mid-20s, as he matures in this league, that this guy can't become a useful two-way player. Maybe even a driver, given his skills both in transition and in terms of winning 50-50 pucks. You know, the case, I think, for not trading Hoglander is, sure, you know, his counting stats, the popcorn stuff, maybe recedes, but I just view him as a guy who should, as he grows up in this league, have more two-way value than he has at the moment, you know, especially given how the Canucks play and especially given his opportunities. To me, like, I can't fathom that he'd just be like, I know he works hard from everything I hear. Like, I know his work rate's not questioned. I don't think he has any, like, processing deficiencies that would cause him to not be able to improve as a defensive option on the wings. So I sort of worry, like, on the one hand, you sell high in terms of his goal totals, but on the other, do you sell high in terms of his perception as a two-way player?
His overall impact, maybe, right? Like, are you actually selling driver. High on that? Yeah.
Right. And I'm telling you right now, like, if a team comes calling and asking about Nils Hoglander, that's the bet they're making. They're not acquiring him thinking he's a 25-goal guy, especially because most of the teams that would have the most time for him are those that, you know, prize data and sort of the attributes that tend to drive, like, you know, the underlying metrics or puck possession, et cetera, the most. So, you know, I just think he's a complicated case. I don't think he's like a classic sell high. This isn't like Kuzmenko. For me, anyway, you know, I mean, I was banging the table about Kuzmenko being a sell high because I'm watching him play and I'm like, well, he's not fast. He doesn't carry the puck through the neutral zone. Hoglander does. He doesn't really win battles. He doesn't really do anything. He's just always scoring goals here. And, you know, I struggle to imagine that he's the best finisher the league's ever seen, which is what he was in his first season. You know, to me, Hoglander's a far more complicated case. I just think there's more there, more development runway. And more potential to be a more valuable piece than he's been, even if the goal totals prove to be something of a mirage.
Well, and I think with Hoglander, and this is kind of applies to a lot of the decisions the Canucks have to make with their players, whether they're UFAs, RFAs under contract, like Nils Hoglander, is it just there's a lot of kind of like edge cases for where they slot in the lineup, right? Like Nikita Zadorov, you know, oh, he's a 4-5, right? Dakota Joshua worked really well as a third liner. Does he have top six potential? Philip Hronek, we're having the debate, right? Is he a true top pairing guy? Or is he more of a 3-4 in the second pair? And I think with Hoglander, what it kind of comes down to is, do you see him as kind of a third line scoring type who can pop occasionally for this type of goal totals, but is never really going to be a credible top six option? Or do you see him as somebody who can not just be a top six option, but I think a top six option you feel really good about down the road, right? Like, not just top six by default, like he was kind of at times this year, but like, hey, we're really comfortable having this guy on our second line because, you know, as you said, he brings all these other things in addition to his goal scoring. And it, like, so much of what this, of these conversations that we're having about should they play this pay this guy X or should they trade this guy just come down to what side of the fence you land on these things, right? Because if you think Hoglander doesn't have the upside you're talking about in terms of being a consistent, really valuable top six guy, then yeah, you absolutely should be exploring trading him this year. But the other thing with Hoglander is, you know, the type of player you're describing, where yeah, he had the goal spike this year, but it's entirely possible that he ends up being a valuable player without massive goal totals down the line. I mean, that's a player that also can sometimes be had for a pretty bargain deal, right? Like, those are the types of players you can win on, valuable players without great counting stats. So that has to factor into it as well, right? Like, if this guy develops in the way that you're outlining, there might be a chance to lock in a bunch of surplus value of Nils Hoglander down the road.
Yeah, I mean, I wish they'd done it last offseason. You know,
I still think that the other world part exists, though. Right? Like, we'll see.
For sure. You know what? It still exists this summer. You're right. But yeah. I wouldn't be trying to sign him off a 24
no,
goal.
No,
campaign.
No, no, no. You wait and see where it goes next year, for sure.
100%. But yeah, I mean, and here's the other thing. You know, he's 1.1 million. Like, if you end up going into next season and your third line is something like Suter, Hoglander, Mikheyev, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't think that's necessarily problematic.
It depends a lot on like who the additional names are in the top six, right?
100%. I'm saying,
but I take your point.
If you're able to go get the winger to play with Besser and Miller, and I guess you'd need two, or I mean Garland,
you'd bump Garland Patterson. Up, and then you'd have to find two wingers in addition.
Yeah. But, you know, it's DeBrusk and Stevenson, and then that's your third line. I think that's fine. You know, I'd rather you have a little more snarl than the lineup I just suggested. But, you know, and then I guess the other argument is, do you worry at all that Garland and Hoglander do the same thing?
Do they do the same thing, though? Like, maybe Hoglander will grow into that more, but, I mean, Garland has so much utility as a playmaker that we haven't really seen from Nils Hoglander. So I don't like.
Garland's
better.
Garland's
obviously
a better offensive.
Yeah.
Huh?
Garland's just better, first of all. Yeah.
Better player. He's a better player, period. Especially right now. You know, he is also 4 years older, right? I mean, he wasn't necessarily a better player when the two were at the same age, mm-hmm. but, you know, Garland has more play driving value at the moment. He's 5 years, so he's 5 years older. Right. So 5 seasons ago, Garland was 18 points in 47 games in the NHL. Right. Like, mm-hmm. is there a concern about redundancy? And this is something that I'm always sort of like, it's something that I like to an extent when you build it into a play style. Right. So like, I liked that, you know, for example, you have Lafferty and DiGiuseppe on your fourth line. And all of a sudden, it's like you can play the sort of like fast-paced pressure game that is this team's bread and butter, even when your top players get a breather. Like, that I like. But then you get like to a point where it's like, and you also have Mikheyev and you have Nils Amon, and all of a sudden it's like, man, there's just a lot of guys in this lineup, and all they can do is play safe. They're not that physical, and mm-hmm. like, you know, they're fast. You know, and it's at some point you can have too much of the same thing. Like, I like some different flavor. In a lineup, ultimately. It's one of the reasons why Joshua would stand out for me, you know, above Bluger, frankly, maybe even above Lindholm, just because he's such a different flavor of forward, of contributor. And a flavor that I think this Canucks team needs. Like, I like what this team looks like with some additional size on it, you know, and some additional sort of finishing skill in tight. So, you know, that would be the one thing that would give me some pause is, like, if I'm trying to go from point A to point B and I want to get bigger and I want to get faster, you know, is the fact that I have these two, you know, Rick Tocchet might describe them as like buzzsaw guys. One of them's, you know, more fleshed out, a better player, a better driver, a better playmaker, but is also shorter and older and more expensive, and the other guy's younger, and maybe he can develop into that, but at least I still have some of that in my lineup. Is that an argument to sell high on one of those guys? You know, I think that's something you consider, but ultimately I like both players and think both players are good, and also think the Canucks didn't lean enough on playing them together.
Well,
right?
That,
like, I really think
that's the interesting thing here, right? Because if they had like similar outputs, but one of them was 6 feet, I don't think we're having this conversation. You know what I mean? I think we're having this redundancy conversation because they're both undersized. And right. The extent to which it's an issue for me is really that it seems like the Canucks would be very reluctant to play them together. So you have two wingers that, as puzzle pieces, don't mesh for Rick Tocchet, and that just creates complications and obstacles to overcome when you're filling out your lineup. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with having two guys who are maybe a little bit similar like that in your lineup, especially if they're both good players and on decent contracts. But if internally,
and play hard,
yeah, exactly. But if internally they just
like neither
they are
soft,
they are. I agree. But if internally they're reluctant to put them together, like it does become just kind of an awkward issue then at that point.
It does, and. It is too bad because I do think that the best version of the Canucks top six that we saw at any point this season was Suter, Miller, Besser, and then Hoglander, Patterson, Garland. And I'm not really sure why they went away from it. But just to sort of boost your point, right? Hoglander and Garland, since Garland came over to the Canucks, have played 180 minutes together.
Yeah.
Only. And by the way, the Canucks have outscored the opposition 10-5 in those minutes and outshot them by 30. So it has worked, but like Garland has played 300 more minutes with Vasily Podkolzin.
Wow.
Like, how's that even possible?
That's wild.
He's played an additional 40 minutes with Nils Amon. I mean, it's just not something they've gone to very often.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're right. I think that reluctance speaks to, you know, the LSAT logic games of it all, right?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And is there a little too much redundancy? Is it too complicated when you look at a whiteboard to sort of figure out how the pieces fit if you've got two guys who are alike enough in the team's mind that they can't just play together? And so, anyway, that would be, I think, the logic of considering one or the other as like a sell high. But in my mind, I'd keep them both. I think they're both really good.
And I think one thing that could help like reduce that issue is if, you know, we saw Garland develop that chemistry with Joshua this year. We don't know if Joshua will be back, but if you have like the natural duo for both of them, then they're less floating around the lineup, right? And you have kind of spots you feel really good about. Didn't totally work for Nils Hoglander with Elias Pettersson this year. How much of that is due to Pettersson? Who knows? But I do think there's a way to have them both being productive in the lineup at the same time. It just requires some ingenuity, I think, when you're drawing up the forward lines. We'll take a break. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We will check in on the Stanley Cup playoffs and also new coaching hire in Seattle for the Kraken. Allison Lucan joins us next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.